New Galaxy Broadcasting proudly presents Integrative Hermetic Health with Hugo Rodier, MD. In this program, we explore a powerful new paradigm for health from the standpoint of integrative medicine. In his practice, Dr. Rodier integrates the ancient Hermetic art and the enduring role of food as medicine with modern nutrition, but also allowing for the wide range of important health practices, including truly valuable medical discoveries, chiropractic, acupuncture, homeopathic and herbal medicine. In this program, Hugo Rodier, an expert in intestinal health and nutrition, will help the audience discover an approach that focuses on actual cures, not the masking of the elegant simplicity of many health solutions for the sake of profit. Profit too long has been an overriding motive of the pharmaceutical companies, and sometimes, sadly, by many in the medical establishment today. Welcome to the Integrative Hermetic Health Show. My name is Johnny Bluestar. I help Dr. Hugo Rodier, the founder and host of the show, to produce the show and help him partially explore the articles which he selects every month as subjects for discussion. I like to advise our listeners that archives on these shows are available at www.newgalaxybroadcasting.com. The articles themselves, including Dr. Rodier's commentary, can be referenced at hugorodier.com. HugoRodier.com, which presents the links to important new articles. By visiting this program, you'll gain more insights into these articles and the power to utilize these insights for your own benefit. I myself have derived great benefit from listening carefully to what Dr. Rodier has to say. Without great health, we really don't have a level of comfort and happiness we need to live complete lives. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Johnny.
Well, today we're going to explore a lot of different things, I think. I get more and more interested in these articles. In some of these cases, I really need your help to just kind of understand certain things. The first one is called Brief Brain Training Rapidly Boosts Neural Networks. It was in Medscape, printing something that I guess was originally in Neurology News, and it's by Damian McNamara. And apparently, healthy volunteers who imagine moving their hands in a specific way during real-time functional magnetic resonance imaging, that's with the MRI, neurofeedback showed that white matter changes and enhanced communication between brain regions is changed in as little as 1 hour, new research shows. The study is the first to demonstrate that brain training can prompt changes in white matter functional anisotropy. I don't know. A measure of myelination in the brain and shows just how rapidly neuroplasticity occurs.
Sure. When I was in medical school in the 80s, we were taught the brain was cast in stone, that there wasn't much chance to change anything about the brain. And of course, there were always mavericks saying that it's not so, but they're in the minority and a bit ostracized, to be honest. But slowly, the science has proven those mavericks right. The brain is extremely plastic. It can be retrained in many, many degrees and many fashions. And of course, you've heard of biofeedback, right?
Yes, I do know about it, yeah.
Yeah, that's the most practical way of getting into retraining brains. Biofeedback clinics are popping up everywhere because the science is so matured. And so in a very practical way, people can help to reprogram their brains from PTSD, anxiety, depression, and a whole lot of other brain programming that can be toxic. And we've talked about this, how our brains are just our thoughts and attitudes are just programming. It can be changed. So there are other people that add to this concept. Biocybernauts is a group of people that focus more on changing the brain waves, train people to put out more alpha waves. And that might ring a bell, right? You're familiar with alpha waves, delta waves, and all those.
I was saying there's been scientific investigation of states of meditation.
So, yes, being familiar with meditation, then you know about alpha waves.
Well, what's really interesting, and I haven't been looking at this for a while, is the work that has been done in biofeedback with reducing seizures and epilepsy. Because I actually helped write a book on that.
Yes, it has.
And so
great.
There's an article, a 2015 article, and it says, new research is showing that biofeedback, a technique using the mind to control physiological responses such as heart rate and respiratory, can reduce seizure frequency. So it has been used. I don't know how successful it's been in general. Do you?
Oh, yes. The science of biofeedback has taken a quantum leap in the last few years. When I was in medical school, it was almost considered quackery. And now we can map the brain with fMRI scans. So we know exactly what part needs a little help under functioning. And of course, you know, we deduce that neurotransmitters are low in those areas of the brain. And now we can couple biofeedback technique to that area to increase function in that area. Video games or music or lights or sounds. And so it used to be that one biofeedback modality fit all. And now it's been individualized because of the fMRI scans. And so it's a very heady time in biofeedback and in retraining the brain. Of course, you know, athletes, for the most part, have known about this for a long, long time. And we have many anecdotal and good studies, also scientific studies, showing how athletes, just by thinking about making free throws, just sitting there in the dark, picturing themselves making free throws, their accuracy increases significantly. And if you talk to any luminary in sports and basketball or soccer, whatever, they'll tell you that they have been able to excel because of their mind control. So this is very encouraging to common people, if you will, who might not be as exalted in their achievements, but to know that we can change a lot of things about the brain. And of course, the most practical application, in my opinion, is anxiety, depression, which are epidemic in our country. And then you get a lot of people with PTSD because of our wars and violent crimes in schools and malls and all that. So that's where I think we're going to see the most application of these techniques of retraining the brain.
Well, here's a quote that sort of validates what you were saying about the earlier days, and now it's going into a new era. Because about this specific brain study that was done, the person who was the investigator, Fernanda Tovar Moyle, from the Brain Connectivity Unit at the Dor Institute for Research and Education in Rio de Janeiro, he says this: "We were happy to identify changes in less than 1 hour. We designed the study to detect such changes, but we did not have high expectations when we started." This is like, I guess, in terms of the specifics of the white matter changes, it's a whole new ballgame.
Yes, the same has been shown in stroke patients. You know, they might end up paralyzed on one side, and they can retrain the brain to where you can gain function by teaching another part of the brain to take over that paralyzed side. And I recall listening to an interview, this very avant-garde physician, with glasses. He would put glasses on people with brain injuries, including himself. He wound up paralyzed after a car wreck. And he was a neurologist, a neuroscientist. So he wasn't going to just lay there, you know, literally. So he began to tinker with this and that. And it led to these glasses that will shift light away from the part of the brain where it would usually go, the back of the brain. He would shift the rays of light coming in through the glasses to another part of the brain to activate that other part of the brain. I forget his name. I should look it up. It's amazing. So, in fact, I do give that website to patients that have had strokes and things like that. But, again, the most practical way for people listening to us to apply this is to give a call to a biofeedback clinic. Like I said, they're popping up everywhere.
Well, I noticed that there's also a possibility of helping people with Parkinson's.
Yes.
And I wanted to mention, in terms of the possibility of eliminating seizures, a lot of these, the pharmaceuticals that are used to treat epilepsy are very iffy. You know what I mean? They may or may not work. They may start working. And to actually being able to change somebody's pattern of brain waves in order to be able to deal with the situation, it's just an amazing possibility.
Yeah, you brought up a little dirty little secret of a seizure training with pharmaceuticals. And I'm not going to say we shouldn't use them, but it has been shown that they stop working. In other words, the brain kind of finds a way to manifest itself through seizures because of injury or genetics, whatever. And so the sad but true, as you said, pharmaceuticals are not the best way to approach this. Although that's what most people know, that's what most doctors know about. But all these other things that we're bringing up, I think will gain more and more acceptability.
Yeah, it's just really a blessing to see how we're moving into health insights that deal with consciousness. And it just seems like we're moving closer to a God-driven health protocol in some areas. Anyway, we're going to have to take a break now. We'll be right back. This is Johnny Bluestar, CEO of New Galaxy Enterprises, a media content development company. The original productions by Amazon, Hulu, and Netflix in particular has opened up a new and powerful form of television that has both global income and still unexplored profit potential as convergence between offline and online media continues to blossom. We can help persons needing creative help to turn their ideas for television pilots into actionable, marketable scripts. There's probably nothing more exciting in the field of entertainment than these new vistas online as that capacity crosses more and more to the big screen. And the opportunities for instantaneous online projections of any type of media in that perennially popular venue. To learn more about New Galaxy, see samples of our work, or talk to us about your project, please go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com and fill out the contact form.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who was a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy, we ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kendall.
Well, we're back on Integrative Hermetic Health Show with Dr. Rodier. Now, Dr. Rodier, we're going to explore an interesting problem, which is that there's something wrong with reproductive capacities of men these days. Have you heard much about that?
Oh, there's been a lot written about this. So these are blows below the belt, two big ones, very big. We've known for quite a while that toxins in the environment messing with our sperm count, and at this rate, we'll be shooting blanks in 2-3 generations. The drop is dramatic.
Well, in this case, they're not only tying it to environmental factors. There's been a big study. I mean, it's a large study here with talking about the relationship between diet and the lower sperm count.
Right. So that's why I said there's two big...
Oh, yeah, I see.
...combination, a one and two punch, if you will.
Yeah.
So we've known about the toxins in the environment, and there's a whole lot of them, over 800 of them. They're dubbed endocrine disruptors, meaning they mess with your hormones, and not only in men, but in women. And so these endocrine disruptors that tend to be pesticides, heavy metals, fluorides, etc., are behind the epidemic of prostate cancer, breast cancer, menstrual irregularities, difficult menopausal changes, but also are behind the drop in sperm counts, and they're blocking testosterone as well. And so this is very concerning to have all these chemicals in the environment that we've been lied about. But now And we should have seen this coming because there have been other articles saying that bad foods, redolent with chemicals and preservatives and food colorings and pesticides and all that, so sort of the same thing. Bad foods are also xenoestrogens, or if you will, endocrine disruptors, meaning they're messing with our endocrine system. This article focuses on the drop of testosterone and sperm counts, but there have been many other articles showing how our diet, through insulin resistance, and we've talked about that, will then go on to affect every cell of the body, because basically you're not getting proper energy to a cell if you have insulin resistance. And so, I mean, talk about motivation. That's how I talk to guys, you know. Frankly, I say, look, what's more important to you? Your bedroom life or your dining room life? And so guys pretty quickly tell me, oh, my bedroom life. Well, of course, you're a man, all right? And so are you willing to eat a Twinkie knowing full well it might mess with your bedroom life later?
Is that your bedside manner, doctor?
Right. Another meaning for bedside manners. I get their attention pretty quickly as to what they'll do when they go home. I don't know, but at least I've planted a seed, no pun intended, for them to start thinking, you know, where are your priorities? And to say nothing about looking a lot better when you stay away from junk food, you know, which has a lot to do with our sexual function, at least in men.
Well, I was just going to mention that this wasn't like an insignificant type of study. This was done in Denmark, and it was done over a span of 9 years from nearly 3,000 Danish men. I'd say that's a pretty good test, isn't it?
Yes, and I believe that a researcher from Salt Lake City, the University of Utah, was involved as well, if I recall.
Really? You know, like one of the things that's just repeating what you said, one of the authors said, sperm count has been declining in the Western countries over the past few decades, and determining the risk factors for this is crucial. Coinciding with the decline in sperm count has been a decline in diet quality. And so it's no surprise that it's not just in Denmark. Actually, I would think they eat maybe a little better in Denmark than other places. But the way they did this was very interesting. They categorized different, in other words, they looked at four different groups. The Western pattern consisted mainly of junk food and snacks. The prudent pattern consisted of fish, chicken, and fresh produce. The smørrebrød, or something, Scandinavian pattern, characterized by cold processed meat, whole grains, and dairy. And then there was a vegetarian pattern. Of the four groups, men who adhered to the prudent pattern consistently had higher sperm counts, lower estradiol levels, and higher 5-HBG, sex hormone-binding globulin, concentrations. So men who followed the Western pattern had lower inhibin B levels and higher free testosterone concentrations higher testosterone concentrations. So the ones that won was the prudent, which did have a lot of protein, right? Meat protein, but fish and chicken protein. That was the one that won, and the one that lost was the Western one, but the Scandinavian and the vegetarian one came sort of in between, right?
Yes. Now, mentioned protein, and I always need to emphasize that we don't get protein just from chicken.
No, I know that. Yes, that's true. I'm your student, remember?
We also get protein from veggies and legumes.
But for some reason, in this particular study, the fish, chicken, and fresh produce won over the vegetarian. But I don't know what the vegetarian was, because it really depends on your diet. It depends on how much protein you get from these different vegetarian products, right?
Yes, but I think the factor that does not get looked into with vegetarians is how much sugar they still eat. Because a whole lot of vegetarians, they feel so deprived, they turn to junk. And that might not have come out in the study. So yes, vegetarianism is the best, but most vegetarians will turn to treats and junk food. Since it's not animal protein, they still call themselves vegetarians. So
yeah, I wound up after 20 years of being a vegetarian, not a vegan, because I was an ovo-lacto. I wound up with really serious diabetic symptoms.
There you go.
And I mean, I was shocked when I realized
I think I may have mentioned the first thing, one of the first things that happened when I decided I better try things different, and this is really terrible. The last meal that I ate before I became a vegetarian was fried chicken. And so I hadn't eaten in 20 years, so I chomped down some fried chicken and I suddenly felt better. I know fried chicken isn't the answer, believe me. So the prudent diet won out in this case. And yeah, you don't have any idea what the vegetarian thing is. Sure could have plenty of sugar. I imagine it didn't have dairy because of the Scandinavian one including dairy. But it could have whole grains, and they don't say that. That's another thing. Well, anyway, but it seems like a very, very insightful move forward to understand that it's environmental chemicals and its diet.
Well, the bottom line of the study again is, men, where are your priorities?
Well, here's another thing. I would like you to define something for me. Metabolic syndrome. Because there's a study here that says that reports that people with metabolic syndrome, a condition which raises the risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, reverses after eating a low-carb diet. But I don't really know what it is.
The metabolic syndrome, as narrowly defined, is cholesterol problems, diabetes, gout, obesity, hypertension. And so the common denominator to all that is insulin resistance. And we've talked about ad nauseum. Now, that's a narrow definition. In my opinion, all problems are metabolic. All problems, health problems, are about energy into cells. Our cells of the body, whether they are eye cells or bone cells or heart cells or brain cells, are they getting proper energy, proper nutrition? And as we've talked, most of the time in disease, they're not. So in my mind, every disease is metabolic. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So the study you quoted is about the narrow definition. That is, by refraining from grains, particularly processed grains, you will then have lower blood pressure, lower cholesterol, lose weight, less chances of gout, your diabetes will get better. And it's a good study, but it still gives me pause because it seems to demonize grains, right?
This one doesn't, I don't see it here. It doesn't mention grains. This is, I don't know which study you're referring to, but this is a very short thing here, a very short description of this low-carb diet. It doesn't mention what it is.
Yeah,
maybe there's more to it.
Right. A low-carb diet, most people will say, oh, that's fewer grains. And yeah, now, I don't think there's anything wrong with grains. I think we're eating too much, too many grains, unrefined. And so, but to completely do away with grains, I don't think it's prudent. Although there are some people that should give up grains. They tend to be paleo people. But that's an exception. I still believe in the prudent diet that we talked about, where you eat a balanced diet. And there's a great book out there called The Omnivore Dilemma. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the guy who wrote the book from Stanford. But anyway, yeah, I think to totally get rid of one group of food can create problems. And we just talked about that. And so it's best to eat the best foods from each group, not processed foods, real food. And I think we come out ahead most of the time that way.
There is one diet that I may be wrong about this, that I think stresses like brown rice and so forth, which is the macrobiotic diet. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Do you know about it? I mean, what do you think of it?
Yes, I think it's very good. It's harder to prepare. But if somebody would like to do that diet, yes, I think that'd be fine.
Does it emphasize brown rice, or is that just a component of it?
I don't think it emphasizes brown rice any more than any other grain.
Oh, I see. Well, I know that, you know, it was very popular before, but I don't think I've heard of it very much recently.
Well, you know, these different diets will have the limelight for a while, and then they go away. And what stays all the time is a Mediterranean diet.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one that gets the more staying power, if you will.
Well, we're going to get back. We'll get back right on that, but we have to take a break now, and we'll be right back.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
If you're not fond of books, you may be interested in watching Dr. Rodier's slide presentation on his website, hugorodier.com. That's HUGORODIER.com. It lasts 48 minutes and explains the simple roots of all diseases with pictures and graphs that are easy to understand. The presentation includes basic principles of physics, philosophy, anthropology, and history to truly integrate the most vital pillars of human health. Before we begin our discussion of the Mediterranean diet, let's hear a little bit from the Mayo Clinic and what diet can do for the brain. This features a 2018 interview with Dr. Maria Vasilaki, an epidemiologist at the Mayo Clinic.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, Tracy, we know that a diet that's filled with fruits and vegetables is good for our waistline, but it's proving to be good for our brain as well. A recent study published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease showed that people with normal cognitive function who followed a Mediterranean diet had lower amyloid deposits in the brain.
As we've learned before on this program, amyloid deposits in the brain are one hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And here to discuss is the lead author of the paper, Mayo Clinic epidemiologist Dr. Maria Vasilaki. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What's good for the body is good for the brain? Is that what we're saying?
This is what we think. There is accumulating evidence suggesting that diet has a beneficial effect for the brain too, and for against cognitive decline and dementia as well. Although we don't have definite evidence for that, but there is a good body of literature supporting that.
Is that what prompted you to do the study?
Yes. In the Mayo Clinic study of aging, we are studying cognitive decline and also biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. So one of them would be the amyloid deposition in the brain. And we had the scans and the data to study that and study the association with diet.
So when we talk about amyloid deposition in the brain, amyloid is, as I recall, it's been a while, a protein, right?
Yes.
And we knew from autopsy studies that patients who had Alzheimer's disease before they died had these deposits of amyloid for whatever reason. So there's an association between the two. And now, if I'm correct, we can actually detect those amyloid deposits on an MRI scan.
Correct. We detect them in, for example, in a PET scan. So we introduce some molecules through the blood and they go and highlight areas of amyloid deposition. So we have the scans and we know the areas where we have elevated amyloid.
And you said that you studied people with normal cognitive function. So how do you determine if somebody's brain is normal and they can be in the study?
Yes. Our participants in the Mayo Clinic Study of Aging, they go a very comprehensive cognitive evaluation with 9 different neuropsychological tests, and then they are evaluated by a physician as well. We also take information by the informant, their partner, so we have a lot of information, and then by consensus, we gather all the information, and the nurse that helped, or the study coordinator, the physician, and the neuropsychologist, they decide, based on data that we have, whether someone would be within the normal function range, or someone would have a little more cognitive decline than we would expect for their age, or whether someone would be in the dementia.
What was the age, the average age of the study participants?
So for this specific study, was 70 years and older. So the mean age is about 78 years old. 55% of them were men.
And what did the study show ultimately?
So we asked them about their eating habits the last 12 months. So they had to answer about 128 different questions on the food groups that they were eating, the amount, and also how often they would. And we found that the individuals that were following closer the Mediterranean diet and those that had a higher consumption of vegetables were less likely to have elevated levels of amyloid deposition in the brain. Now, we have to point out that this is a cross-sectional study in our terminology, which means this is like a photograph. We don't have the dimension of time, so we don't know what came first and what came second. So as we say in our area of research, we cannot assess the causality between the two. However, this is information that supports previous information that we know that diet has a beneficial effect. There is also the possibility that another factor could be in place that we haven't measured, that we don't know about it yet. Hmm. But this is a first sign that our study showed supporting evidence of a beneficial association.
We all have talked about it, and we've talked about it on this program, but refresh our memories with regard to the Mediterranean diet. We know that it's mostly fruits and vegetables, but what can't you eat or shouldn't you eat if you're on that diet?
Why would you look at the negative part? What do you get to eat on the Mediterranean diet?
If she's right, then yeah. We don't want to become demented later in life. Maybe right. There's something to that.
So it's a very colorful diet. It's high in the consumption of fruits and vegetables, legumes, nuts, also moderate to high consumption of fish, less consumption of meat and saturated fats, and more fats in terms of olive oil are consumed in the diet. There is optional moderate use of alcohol as well, mainly wine. And usually it happens in social occasions.
Was wine on the list or not on the list?
Wine was on the list for the Mediterranean diet when we started studies in the 1960s. Now, alcohol is optional in a way because for some of the conditions we should not drink. It's very idiosyncratic if we cannot control the amount of wine. So it's really optional.
All right. The question is, people who have followed this diet for their entire life, people who live in the Mediterranean, I guess, mm-hmm. do they have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease than we have?
So, I don't have a definite answer on that. As far as research is concerned, very rigorous clinical trials research. So, we don't have definite evidence to suggest dietary interventions in our life today. We have, though, a big amount of observational data and some clinical trials that would support that a good balanced diet like the Mediterranean diet, but also other diets like the DASH diet or the MIND diet that were associated with slower cognitive decline.
So I'm not familiar with either one of those, the DASH and the, what was the other one?
Mind. So the DASH diet is dietary approaches to stop hypertension. So, and the MIND is Mediterranean DASH interventions for neurodegenerative delay.
So having studied this, are you pretty much convinced that a Mediterranean diet is a good idea, not just for overall health, but also to prevent cognitive decline? Are you convinced?
I think we need to learn much more, but we have enough to follow the advice of decades now to have a good, balanced, healthy diet, and the Mediterranean diet pattern is one of them. The good thing is that although we don't have any new recommendation based on this study, and although we said it's like a photo, a cross-sectional study, it adds an additional motivation that what is good for my general health, what is good for my cardiovascular, can support my brain health. And that can happen directly, maybe through defense mechanisms, or indirectly supporting my cardiovascular system, which also would be very important for brain health and dementias.
We have 30 seconds left. What's next in your research?
So what we would like to do, and other researchers also are doing, is to follow people longitudinally. to see whether we follow the Mediterranean diet or any other beneficial diet pattern, whether changes in our biomarkers in the brain, amyloid, for example, or changes in our cognition, beneficial changes are associated with a good balanced diet.
We've been discussing how diet may play a role in preventing or delaying cognitive decline and dementia with Mayo Clinic epidemiologist Dr. Maria Vasilaki. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Vasilaki.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
This is Johnny Bluestar, back with Dr. Hugo Rodier on the Integrative Hermetic Health Show. And we were just discussing some information about a low-carb diet, and we got into a discussion about different types of diets. And Doctor, you were mentioning how of all these diets that appear and disappear in our world, the Mediterranean diet just still keeps breathing a lot of life.
Yes. You know, the name that I forgot is Michael Pollan. P-O-L-L-A-N, he wrote Omnivore Dilemma. And I think he's the most rational of all the people out there because he's a sort of a middle grounder, you know, no extremes. I have to agree with that. But the Mediterranean diet, this goes to a very important point of integrative health. We have alluded to it even today. Very ancient principles, very simple principles win out every time. And we get sidetracked by a whole lot of noise for different reasons. They sound very scientific, but still the core principles that the ancients knew about, consciousness, you brought that up, how our scientific researchers are getting more and more into consciousness, even how it affects health. And take, for instance, the ancients, how they were very aware of Thoth or Hermes, hence the name of our show, Hermetic Health.
Right.
And the West became more familiar with that whole concept of integration, Hermes, the Caduceus and all that, when the Medici sent a monk to the Middle East to get the books of Thoth, which turned out to be 42 books, 36 of which were about health. And that triggered the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And so our concept of health, yours and mine, Johnny, is much more expansive than what we see preached about and sold in this toxic, broken healthcare system, isn't it? And so going back to the Mediterranean diet, well, the very name tells you what's going on. The cradle of civilization in many ways, many researchers will tell you, was Africa and then the Mediterranean and then on to Europe and other countries. So the focus for us Westerners is the Mediterranean. And so the very diet that these ancient people have been eating for millennia turns out to be the best for us. Well, what a coincidence. And so that's why, you know, anytime I see a new diet come around, you know, I'll read about it and all that. But often I find that it's been touted and pushed by someone trying to make a buck.
Yeah, well, that's very true. But it's also true that diet is such a tricky thing. And I think what happens is that certain people, specific conditions that are helped tremendously by a certain diet, and they try to generalize it and make it for everybody, like particularly I think of paleo. I read the book, but basically this guy became, well, anyway, someone became very, very sick on a vegetarian diet.
Right, the same with Atkins and a whole lot of other people.
Whatever you do, you actually have to be careful to customize it to yourself. And when you have a certain diet that's in a book, you have to say, okay, well, a lot of it might be true, but I'm going to use my intelligence. I'm not going to just take a vacation from it because I like the book, right?
Yeah. Speaking of technology, if you want to take all this to the next level,
okay,
then you would look at your microbiome because that determines what diet is the best for you. And so our microbes and the process were examined, if you will, the food you eat. So you and I could eat soy, and it's very bad for you and very good for me. What's the difference? My gut bacteria that converts the soy into egg wall, a molecule that has been shown to be 100% healthy, very good for your health. But if you don't have the right bacteria to process soy into egg wall, then soy will not be so good for you. And then the liver itself, when it comes to soy, has a lot to do with how you process soy. And of course, remember, the liver takes its marching orders from the microbiome as well. So yes, I mean, the easy way to look at a diet is trial and error, the weight of evidence. But at the same time, if you want to get really technical, want to check your microbiome.
How do you do that? What kind of a test is it?
Well, there are several tests. The ones that I'm most fond of when it comes to ascertaining what foods you should be eating is Viome, V-I-O-M-E. And you can Google that, Viome, V-I-O-M-E. You'll see what they offer. They'll send you the kit. They'll send you the results. You don't even have to go to a doctor to get it done.
Well, what are you doing? I mean, what part of your physiology are you dealing with? I mean, how do you do this test? Is it...
Well, like I was saying, you're looking at the microbiome, so you send them stool.
Oh, stool.
Yeah, they will look at the genetics of your microbiome and what foods they prefer. The other test I like is diagnostic solutions. They look at the bacteria you have, not so much a food. And so both are useful.
What do you use with the diagnostic solutions? Stool as well?
Stool as well. You're looking at the microbiome.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, that one you need a doctor. That one, a doctor has to order it for you, and then they send the doctor the results, because if you have a really messed up microbiome, that is, you're lacking in certain healthy bacteria and have too many of the bad guys, you will need a doctor to help you re-equilibrate your microbiome.
Well, suppose you get this Viome one, comes back.
Yeah, no, you don't. It's pretty specific. It tells you... Gives you three lists of foods. One list, food you should not be eating at least until you correct your microbiome. Another group of foods that you should eat once in a while. And another group of food that you should eat often.
Well, what about the microbes? I mean, the probiotics.
But that's what I was telling you. The Viome looks at food only. The diagnostic solutions looks at what good bacteria you're lacking and what bad bacteria you should go after.
So which is superior?
Well, they're not superior. They're different. Viome is about food, the food you should be eating. The diagnostic solutions and the other companies as well are looking at the bacteria. Now, for best results, you'd want to do both.
Ah, that's what I wanted to know. Yeah. So there are people who have tricky situations, right?
Right. And that's why... you know, it's best to have a consult with a doctor as to where to start.
The next part of our discussion is going to be on this is something that greatly upsets me, which is cancer treatments. And this is one about a certain cancer treatment, radioactive iodine treatment for overactive thyroid. And the study says that it increases long-term cancer risk. This is a retrospective study. It was reported in Health Day. It found patients who received radioactive iodine treatment for an overactive thyroid have an increased long-term risk for cancer death. The lead study author, Carlos Kitahara, says, "We estimated that for every 1,000 patients treated currently using a standard range of doses, about 20 to 30 solid cancer deaths would occur as a result of this radiation exposure." That sounds rather extraordinary to me. Is it?
Yes. It's not a common problem. We should point out that radiation of the thyroid gland in the neck is done mostly for people with hyperthyroidism, people whose thyroid gland in the neck is too active. So you don't a whole lot of thyroid hormones through your system that might overstimulate the heart. We call it a thyroid storm and lead to a heart attack. It's a rare thing. But if it happens to you, it's not so rare. So doctors for a long time have said, let's just kill the thyroid and then we give you synthetic thyroid to make up the difference and then you're good. You avoided that potential for a thyroid storm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So keep your eye on the ball. That's the basis of it. And it's been recommended to avoid litigation, to avoid someone having a heart attack. You can see how doctors would more likely to recommend that and be done with it, and then there's no risk of bad outcome. Until it happened to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, about 20 years ago. And I wasn't about to get radiated. And I thought to myself, look, the thyroid is overactive because it's getting ready to die. Much like diabetics, it's unknown that most diabetics have too much insulin because of insulin resistance. And so a diabetic then, if he or she goes down that path, will end up running out of insulin because you're putting out too much insulin on account of insulin resistance. So the analogy here is the thyroid is overactive because it senses it's about to die and it's trying to compensate. Do you follow?
Yeah.
All right. So what is the harm, I thought, in just letting it die? Don't kill it overnight with the atomic nuclear radiation. I just wasn't about to drink that stuff. But if I can be very diligent and check my blood very often to make sure it's not getting away from me and be there ready to supplement when it finally dies. What's the harm in that? So that's how I did it. I checked my blood every week, and then I took a beta blocker like propranolol to block the heart from racing away from me if it was overstimulated. And then I took methimazole, which is a drug that interferes with thyroid function. And so I was able to, over a period of 2 months, watch my thyroid die a natural death. When it died, I was checking the blood often so I knew exactly when to stop the beta blocker and the thyroid blocker and start thyroid as I would have done had I had the nuclear radiation overnight. And so here I am.
20 years later, right?
Yeah, years later, I have to take thyroid, true. But that's the same outcome if I had it radiated. And that's what I do with my patients. When they come in with hyperthyroidism, I tell them, here's your choice. You can go to the endocrinologist, they'll radiate it with radioactive material, or you can do it this way like I did it. Guess how many people choose to go to have it radiated?
I think a lot of them.
Zero.
Really?
Because I take the time to explain what I just told you. So who, if they realize that if they're just diligent and let me check their blood often and give them those two drugs, the chances of a thyroid storm and a heart attack are pretty low. Now, zero. So I make sure they understand that their choice must be educated and mature, and I blame me.
This particular study is about possibility of dying of cancer.
Right.
And so, like, you can add that to the story you tell them, I guess. not only can you die with a heart attack, you can also die of cancer.
Yeah, so you want to die quickly or slowly? This information to my next patient with hyperthyroidism, because we didn't know this. And intuitively, I kind of figured it wasn't good. Like every patient that comes in, when you mention, hey, go have your thyroid radiated, every one of them recoils and says, really? Yeah, because intuitively, yeah, why would you want to do that?
I forgot that your patients are smarter than most people anyway. We have to say goodbye now, doctor. I really appreciate the insights you've given us today. And every day, every time we have a conversation like this, I feel a little bit more enlightened.
Well, thank you, Johnny. Thanks for your help on all you do in disseminating all this good information.
Well, we'll see you next week then. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Coalition is a unique project designed to empower its members both individually and collectively. Besides individual empowerment, its broader focus is on the restoration, protection, and enhancement of citizen and human rights throughout the world through the aid of its members. As this project is centered in the United States, our first task is to create a website and social network infrastructure to promote collective efforts to take back our rightful control as citizens over our government as designed by our founding fathers. Although we must begin with a social network restricted to United States citizens, the organization will also host a global dialogue for the discussion of human rights by citizens of democratic nations throughout the world. If you're interested, please check us out in the GoFundMe.com website, entering in the search field, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment. That is, go to GoFundMe.com and enter in the search field, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment. For more information about Dr. Rodier's practice, books, blogs, and newsletters, contact Hugo Rodier, MD, at www.hugorodier.com. That's HUGORODIER.com. We go out with a very deep song by Lightstorm called I Am.
I am without and within the silence of all. I am reposing in bliss while dancing as light. I am the great imposter, the seed of illusion. Of life, the pure sound of Om. I am the way. than the foam of this cosmic ocean I am. The silent secret that rests at the bottom I am. Devastation in dream separation, I am the lover of love, the bride of awareness, I am the true self in all, the ultimate bridegroom, I am all mad desperation. Final elation, I am the desolate pain of wanting and longing, I am the tender love flame inside every heart, I am exposed in all living by burning. A shattered glass pane, yet always the same, I am.